Why is Diane on my mind? Record-breaking gun violence in the U.S. This week, an assailant entered a church school in Nashville and shot and killed six people, three children, three adults. This is just one of more than 130 mass shootings recorded in the country so far this year. Meanwhile, the response in Washington has been pretty much what you'd expect. Democrats calling for an assault weapons ban, Republicans saying we need more police. Daniel Webster at Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions joined me for a conversation that moves beyond the gridlock to talk about what real solutions to the issue might look like. But first, a conversation with New York Times reporter Christina Caron about her project on how the prevalence of gun violence has changed us. Christina, tell me about your recent project at the New York Times about gun violence. You posted it just hours before the shooting in Nashville.
That's correct. And we couldn't have anticipated that timing, but I guess I can't say I'm surprised at this point. When we were preparing to work on this piece, we knew that the next episode of mass violence was just around the corner, unfortunately. So what we had done was asked New York Times readers to tell us how the threat of gun violence is affecting their life, if at all, and if so, how. We also wanted to know how it affects their mental well-being. And we had gotten over 600 responses. This is not representative of the country because we weren't doing a formal research study, but among the people who did respond, we heard a lot of variation. So there were people who, on one hand, said that they were feeling numb and resigned. One woman said, ever since Sandy Hook, she's not proud of it, but she's become numb. And she feels that if we couldn't change anything to help our children, then nothing is going to change. Other people talked about feeling angry and really frustrated. And I think what's really clear from these responses, and what was so interesting about it to me, is that although some of our respondents did have direct experience with gun violence, either they had lost someone they loved, or they had witnessed it, or they had actually survived gun violence, a lot of people didn't. A lot of people did not have any direct experience with gun violence, and they too were deeply affected as well. So it's almost as though when you throw a pebble into a pond, there's a ripple effect. Gun violence, it's clear from these responses, affects us all. It's a public health problem. It's a public mental health problem. And I think there are two reasons why people are feeling especially frustrated and vulnerable. One is the uncertainty. Whether you live in a neighborhood where there's daily gun violence or whether you're afraid of a mass shooting, you do not know when or where it could happen. When these episodes are in the news, there's a feeling of randomness about it almost. Why that town? Why that school? Why then? So there's uncertainty. And then in addition to that, people feel helpless because they do not know how to fix this, how to go about fixing it. Why hasn't it been fixed yet? What's stopping us? And those two things combined, I think, really exacerbate the anxiety around this topic.
How did going through this material affect you and your thinking about gun violence?
It was very sobering to look through these responses, and I will say it also made me feel a little anxious too, because so many of the people were saying that they had taken specific precautions to try to avoid gun violence. They are not attending crowded events when in the past they used to do that without any worry. Or they're choosing in some cases to send their child to a private school because they feel as though private schools may be somewhat safer. Of course, we just saw a shooting happen at a private school. But it's true, more often than not, you do see public schools mentioned when there is something like a mass shooting. And that is reflective of the fact that there are far more public schools in the country than private schools. But really, it started to make me question, you know, are there things I should be doing? You know, should, you know, now, in some cases, people don't have an option. I do have to take public transportation. My oldest daughter does go to public school, and that's how it's going to stay. That's not an option for us to change. But I think what I had to then remind myself of is that something like I was saying before, like something like a mass shooting is far less common than the daily gun violence that we encounter in many neighborhoods throughout the country. And it's easy when we see all of this coverage in the news media to feel as though nothing is safe, that we can't. Some people were saying they don't even want to vacation in places where there are more lax gun laws. I think people have to do whatever feels right for them. And if that helps them feel less anxious, then that's what they should do. But we also have to be continually evaluating what is the true risk in any scenario and how comfortable are you with that level of risk.
So all in all, what is your takeaway from the survey you've done?
So I really do think that this is indicative of, like I said before, the ripple effect that happens when gun violence occurs in our country, that I think very few of us could claim to be immune from the mental health ramifications of gun violence, even if we don't have direct experience with gun violence. Just hearing about it can be really stressful and anxiety producing. And when you live in a neighborhood where there is daily gun violence, that stress is continual. I think it points to how we need to urgently find solutions, because we already have a mental health crisis in this country. We already know that children and particularly teenage girls are struggling, according to the latest data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And we need to do everything we can to try to limit the amount of gun violence in this country. It's really gotten out of control when you look at a statistic that says that now among children and teenagers, it is guns that are the number one cause of death. And there is no other similarly large or wealthy country where that is the case. I wrote about this last year as well. I wrote about the mental health ramifications of gun violence. And so it's a topic that's been on my mind for quite some time. And I do, you know, in my own family, unfortunately, my spouse's nephew died by gun violence at the age of 21. And this was incredibly devastating to the entire family. So I know from our family's experience and from having heard from our readers and having spoken to experts about this, that it is an enormous public health problem that we just need to resolve.
Can you say more about what happened in your own family?
I think for the sake of their privacy, I would prefer not to in that case. But it was completely unexpected. You know, he had so much promise ahead of him.
Of course.
Yeah, it's really devastating to think about how that family's life is forever changed, and that nothing will ever be the same for them again. You know, not not for the parents, yeah. not for his younger brothers. Like, it's just, it's going to be a very, very long process, maybe a never ending process to, I don't think you ever get closure with something like that. You know, the good news there was they did apprehend the person who did it, who had actually also killed other people. And he, the person who they eventually caught, he was only 19 years old. Yep.
I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
No. That puts it incredibly close. I mean, did you pursue this because of what happened in your own family?
I would say that was part of it. Not the entire reason, but I had also worked on a piece about grief that was largely, I guess, a result of having seen family members go through such powerful grief in that case. So, you know, I guess the takeaway from this is that I think it's really rare now, unfortunately, to come across someone who doesn't have some kind of experience with it. It may be a relative, it may be a friend or a friend of a friend. But gun violence has become so prevalent that I am actually now working on a piece about how to emotionally support the survivors and family members of those affected by gun violence, because I realized there wasn't very much written about that. There's a lot written about how to, for example, speak to children about gun violence when it happens, or how to financially help those who might have been affected by gun violence. But there hasn't been much written about how to emotionally support people. And I think, given that I cover mental health, that's a really important thing to talk about, because this sort of violence is different in some ways than other kinds of trauma. That's one of the next pieces I'm working on.
More than 20 years ago, I spoke with a professor at Harvard University who was pushing and pleading for gun violence to be designated as a public health issue. That's still on the table.
20 years ago. That's unbelievable.
I mean, it's extraordinary.
Wow.
And that's something I gather you're concerned with as well, mm-hmm. making the public realize, making the legislators realize that this has become a public health issue. What would that mean if, in fact, it were so designated?
I would like to believe that we would be, first of all, offering more resources to those who have been affected by gun violence. I think people will sometimes turn to community organizations for help, but there isn't really, I don't think, a structural way to support people who are in these circumstances. And hopefully it would eventually lead to more research and more money being allocated to research that could help prevent gun violence. And, you know, I share in people's feelings of a bit of helplessness, but if we were to succumb to that feeling, then really nothing will change at all. So even though I realize it's been decades, many decades that we've been dealing with this, we can't give in to that feeling.
Christina Caron, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's such an honor to speak with you today. And I'm so grateful that you took interest in this work and that you want to share it with your audience. Thank you for doing that.
That was Christina Caron of the New York Times. When we come back, my conversation with Daniel Webster of Johns Hopkins University. Hi, it's Diane. Join me for my next book club event, a conversation with Sheila Johnson. She's co-founder of BET, all about her memoir, Walk Through Fire. That's coming up Wednesday, April 24th at 6 p.m. Eastern. Find out more. Register at dianeweem.org/book club. And we're back. Here is my conversation with Daniel Webster, distinguished scholar for the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions. Professor Webster, you've been studying gun violence for more than 30 years. This morning, the New York Times defines a mass shooting as involving four people or more. And they are saying we've had about 130 incidents here in the U.S. just since the start of the year. And it certainly seems to be a higher number than we've seen in previous years. Why are these numbers accelerating?
So it's important to know that mass shootings, of course, are a subset of all shootings. And what we have been seeing is increases in all forms of gun violence, including mass shootings. So when we try to think about, well, what are driving these trends of more and more shootings, I think that the things that come to mind for me is we have greater access to guns, increases in gun sales beginning with the onset of the pandemic. There was a lot of panic and uncertainty among people across the country about their security. We had unprecedented levels of gun acquisition. And unlike prior spikes in gun purchases, we had more people acquiring guns for the first time. So you not only have more guns per person, you have more people with guns. So that, I think, is relevant. We also experienced really challenges across the board in law enforcement. Of course, 2020, we had many big protests against acts of police violence. It disrupted the relationship between police and the communities that they are supposed to serve. As someone who studies this, I will tell you, in Baltimore and Chicago and many other cities, when you have those sort of disruptions, it tends to mean more violence will occur after the fact. Police pull back, community pulls back. So I think those are relevant phenomenon. I also think that shootings, whether they are mass shootings or other shootings, are often driven by grievances. Someone feels aggrieved. If they have ready access to a firearm, they may act on that. And I think sort of the controls of people not responding to those grievances with guns have diminished. So we are living in, pardon me, in a time of more turmoil, more hostility, and more guns.
And there is also this feeling that perhaps buying guns is going to make people feel safer somehow. And yet, I gather some statistics indicate when a gun is in the house, there is more likely to be violence.
Yes, homes with guns in them have a greater risk of experiencing a homicide or actually more commonly a suicide with a firearm. Because again, we have conflicts, we have suicidal thoughts. If we have ready access to a gun, the outcome can be fatal. If there's no gun, typically you live through those hard times, whether they, again, are self-directed or directed against someone else. So typically more guns in a community, in a household, in a state or a nation will result in more people shot.
And is the U.S. considered, therefore, one of the more violent countries in the world?
That's a great question. In many metrics of violent crime, bullying in schools, domestic violence, we are really not an outlier among high-income countries. What we are an outlier in is the lethality of our violence, and that is driven largely because of we have far more guns. And I want to underscore this point, which is it's not just access to guns. It is lax regulations so that those guns get into the hands of people with histories of violence. That is what is important. And part of our whole debate in our society is are the guns to blame? Are they not to blame? Most people who own guns are not going to harm themselves or anybody else. And that is just a true from what we know in the data. But there is a subset of individuals with ready access to a firearm. They are going to cause harm to others and or themselves. And we have set up far fewer regulations or strong regulations to keep guns out of the hands of individuals with histories of violence.
What about the issue of mental illness, which is what many politicians point to when an act of mass gun violence takes place, when opposing voices talk about the availability of guns?
So there's a couple of responses to that. One is, it's not an either-or question. Violence is caused by many factors. It's never one thing. Separately, we tend to immediately assume anyone who commits an act of mass violence or mass homicide, no one can do that in their right mind. And the truth is that most people who carry out these acts of mass violence with guns do not have any diagnosable mental illness. They may have a lot of issues going on. They may have difficulty controlling their anger. They may have lots of grievances. A variety of things might be going on. But severe mental illness typically is not what is driving those. Occasionally, yes. Mental illness and look, we could do well to invest more in mental health services and prevention and have great benefits in our society. How much we would change the incidence of mass shootings is quite debatable. And my hunch, based upon the available data, is it would have only a very marginal effect.
Well, then, what actions could work to curb this kind of violence that we're seeing?
Well, when you look at gun policies, the type of gun policy that my center, the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions, has studied and found most efficacious on multiple forms of gun violence, including mass shootings, is a licensing requirement for those who purchase firearms, or even very specifically handguns. Handguns, folks should know, are used in roughly 90% of murders in the United States. These mass shootings with a lot of casualties, you will often see an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle. But in terms of the more common everyday kind of gun violence, it's more commonly handguns. But getting back to the policy is a licensing system where if you are going to purchase a firearm, you need to first go directly to a law enforcement agency and apply, be fingerprinted to verify your identity, ideally have some safety training requirement. What we found is that this is a far better way to do background checks, to prevent the diversions of guns to underground markets through straw purchases or other mechanisms. We find significantly reduced rates of firearm homicides, suicides with guns, shootings involving law enforcement, whether victim or as shooting civilians. And as I said, we also see that there is no policy that has a stronger protective effect in reducing fatal mass shootings.
What about comprehensive background checks?
Comprehensive background checks are part of a licensing, but you can have comprehensive background checks without licensing. The studies we've done in collaboration with colleagues at University of California, Davis, where we've compared the effects of licensing with comprehensive background checks versus comprehensive background checks without licensing. And we don't see as measurable effects with comprehensive background checks without a licensing system. So we think of it as a very important, necessary component to any regulatory system, but it really is far more effective when you have a licensing component. Let me just briefly explain why. Because sure. Without a licensing component, the way comprehensive background checks work is if I wanted to sell you a gun, Diane, and we're doing this in a legal fashion, I would say, meet me at the gun shop, 5 minutes away, and you're going to fill out a form, and the guy at the gun shop will submit that to law enforcement for a background check. That's a very different kind of requirement and experience than if I say, Diane, before I can sell you a gun, you have to go to the police department. They're going to do a careful vetting of you. The person at the gun shop is there to sell guns, okay? That is what they do. And in this case, they're there to collect a fee for accepting a form that you are giving them. Someone in law enforcement, their job is to protect us, to protect the communities, right? So it's a very different rigor with which that whole process occurs.
I see. What about the sale of AR-15s? What happens there? I mean, there was a ban on those weapons that has now been lifted, and President Biden is trying to get that reinstated. What would a new ban on AR-15s do in the way of slowing or halting these incidents of mass shootings?
That's a legitimate question, and here's my response, is when either I or any researcher studies that question, we can only look backward in time and say, okay, when and where did jurisdictions or in, we had a federal ban for a while that had its own limitations, but we see whether there's correlations when these kind of laws are adopted and the incidence of fatal mass shootings. So we can look backwards in time and answer that question. I have to say it's a different question when you're looking forward, because there are far more AR-15s available now in the population, and a huge, huge challenge if you're going to try to ban them now than many years ago. When we've studied this, what we have found is that we have not seen a very clear association between bans of assault weapons. That's partly because of leakiness and weaknesses in those bans and regulations. We did, however, find a statistically significant and protective effect of banning high-capacity magazines or ammunition feeding devices. That is the feature of assault-style rifles or pistols that is most relevant when you're talking about mass casualties. How many rounds can you fire uninterrupted without having to change out your magazine, your clip? So we found that when you ban high-capacity magazines, you do indeed have lower incidence of fatal mass shootings and fewer people shot in those incidents.
I think there are a lot of folks who believe that this is really primarily an urban problem. But what happens in rural areas? Is there a comparable data to show what happens between the two?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of times the rhetoric and conversation when you turn to the subject of gun violence makes an assumption that we only have gun violence in large cities, and that is yes. far from the case. What we find is that some of our rural counties actually have higher rates of homicide than do our cities. And that is particularly true in states with very high rates of gun ownership. Now, the nature of that violence may vary somewhat. In more rural communities, it's more likely to be domestic violence than, say, gang violence. But nevertheless, guns do play an important role in higher rates of firearm homicide. But actually, the relationship is even stronger with firearm suicides. We found that, that again, licensing requirements really reduce suicide rates across the board, across all jurisdictions, including, you know, more rural jurisdictions.
Have there been studies which might indicate whether state-by-state laws are as effective or even more effective than a national federal law might be with this issue of real licensing before purchase?
Right. So I think that almost anyone who studies this would say that, and anyone, frankly, who just thinks about the problem would come to the conclusion that a federal regulation or policy is going to be more effective than us just having that regulation at the state level, because guns indeed do cross state borders. We studied that, and they typically come from states with the weakest gun laws into the states with the strictest gun laws. Having said that, we find that some laws, again, particularly licensing, but there are other laws as well, do have a favorable impact at the state level. The reason that is the case is that, look, gun markets are similar to other marketplaces. If there's a shortage of guns on the underground market in a state with stricter gun laws, in order to, for those same, you know, potential consumers in an underground market, if they're going to access guns, they have to find out-of-state sources. That comes with higher risk and higher cost. And in any marketplace, the riskiness of a product or service or whatever and the price matters in terms of how many people consume that product. And that is true with guns.
So you believe that federal laws would help?
Oh, federal laws definitely would help, unquestionably. They would be far more effective than each, you know, some states having strict laws and some having
exactly.
weak laws. The point I was trying to make is that a lot of people too quickly come to the conclusion that a state's laws won't matter because of interstate gun trafficking. Again, the data clearly show that weak laws facilitate interstate gun trafficking, but they don't completely eliminate protective effects of a state taking its own measures to make sure that people with histories of violence don't access firearms.
So how does the issue of politics play into the impact of guns and the whole discussion around guns in your mind?
Well, it's never been the case more than now that how you feel about guns and gun regulations is very much correlated with your party affiliation or generally where you are on the political spectrum. It's almost impossible to be a Republican who favors gun control these days. That didn't used to be the case. I want to be clear. So that trend has gotten even, you know, more clear and dramatic. And conversely, you know, most people who are going to be pushing for stronger gun laws tend to be on the left side of the political spectrum and more likely be Democrat. So this is, you know, what is possible and what is not is very much dependent upon the political party that has, you know, the most power and ability to, you know, put their views about guns into place.
Well, a very sad thought comes to my mind, which is it too late? Are there already too many guns out there to do anything about control?
So that's a good and logical question that we need to wrestle with. What I'll say is when I began my career in the early 1990s, we actually had much, much higher rates of firearm homicide than we do now. The feeling right then was incredibly pessimistic. How will we ever, ever address this problem of gun violence? It seems like guns are everywhere. There's nothing we can do about it. Well, guess what? Within a span of about 6 years, you had a drop of about 50% in the rate of firearm homicide.
How come?
No, there have been lots of studies and debate about that. And again, never one single factor. There were changing drug markets. There were changing emphasis on regulating and enforcing gun laws. There were changing economies. There was a whole bunch of things that were changing. Actually, one very interesting thing from a public health standpoint is there were fewer people whose brains and were harmed by environmental lead, which tends to increase impulsivity and aggression and is very strongly correlated with violence. So if you go, when we ended leaded gasoline and started to change regulations about what kind of paint we could use in our homes, the kids growing up after that were less likely to be harmed by lead. So there's a number of factors. So what I would say is that, look, guns are durable products, so they're going to be around and they're going to be a challenge for us. But when we look at which guns are used and by whom, we must recognize that the newer guns are more likely to be used than the older guns. Guns that someone has had around for a long time and are locked up in someone's home, in some gun case, generally are pretty low risk. What we're worried about is ready access to newer firearms, particularly for younger individuals. So, you know, as people come of age into young adulthood where rates of violence and homicide are highest, how easily can they get guns? And that will depend upon not only how many guns generally are there available in our society, but what are the regulations and enforcement mechanisms in place? So I do think that the recent spike in gun acquisition will be a challenge for the years ahead, but it's not, it won't necessarily mean that there's no way we can lower rates of gun violence in the United States.
One last thought. If gun violence in our country were designated formally as a public health issue, what difference might that make?
I think it would make a big difference. And I'll explain that briefly. If we think about the problem of gun violence simply as a bad people problem that we assign to the law enforcement criminal justice system, look, we always are going to need that system to be effective in addressing gun violence. But when you approach the problem from a public health perspective, the ways that you can tackle this problem really are much broader and greater. We can address early stages of patterns of violence and prevent those. We can, of course, have better regulations on the availability of guns so that you don't get into the hands of people who might be vulnerable to use them against others or themselves. But also, what public health approaches are about is changing the conditions that promote violence. Part of that is guns, but part of that is too much density of alcohol outlets in a community where there's way more alcohol than there is safe, healthy food. When we address blight and disinvestment in communities that have been harmed by structural racism and redlining, we know we can lower rates of gun violence. We can do a variety of very practical things that change those conditions in neighborhoods. And sometimes they're as simple as better street lighting. So there's a variety of ways when you, as a public health orientation, you really expand your ability to change the conditions that promote violence rather than just wait for violence to occur and arrest someone after the fact.
But you know, Harvard University has been talking about making this a public health issue for at least 20 years. Why hasn't it happened?
Well, just to be clear, Johns Hopkins has been talking about it as a public health problem for the same amount of time as Harvard. But quite honestly, at a local level in particular, this is definitely taking hold. There are mayors across the country, including in Baltimore City, who have really embraced public health approaches, not as the single, magic thing, but that is a more holistic way to address a very large and complex problem. So you're seeing this very much at the city level. You're seeing it at some state levels as well. And I think that this is not a fad. I think this is something that will be with us for a long time. Again, my prediction is we too commonly sort of hold up public health as sort of an alternative to addressing the problem with law enforcement. I view them as complements. We need to have effective, fair, equitable law enforcement. But we need a public health prevention approach that complements that, because we have an enormous problem of gun violence that is a leading cause of death for children and has enormous social costs that we just shouldn't tolerate.
And finally, Professor Webster, how much the risk of that violence affects you in particular, emotionally or physically?
Well, thank you for asking, Diane. Look, there are times where this can be overwhelming. And, I have to sort of go into a corner and have a little cry or scream or, do some outlet. But I'm very fortunate to have colleagues who support me. The last thing I'll say is, over my more than 30 years working on this, I've met so many people directly impacted by gun violence who have lost dear ones, loved ones, and they give me great hope and energy when I feel really despondent about the problem, because they're remarkably resilient and committed to addressing this problem so that fewer people lose their loved ones.
Are you taking steps to change your own behavior when you're going into a crowded market or?
So I would say, look, I've always been very self-aware when I'm in a variety of spaces that I think could be risky. Some people make the decision that they're going to arm themselves and carry a gun around with them. That is not a decision that I have made for myself. I'm not sure I would trust myself in those kind of very stressful moments of and being able to live with the consequences of that. My own orientation to this problem is this is a communal problem. We need to solve this as a collective, as a community, as communities, rather than just say, oh my God, this is a violent society. I'm just going to take care of myself and I'm going to carry a gun everywhere I go. I think if everyone just acts on that instinct and orientation, we will have far more gun violence, far less safety, a lot more trauma.
Professor Webster, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Diane.
That was Daniel Webster, Bloomberg Professor of American Health in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. Our engineer today is Adrian Danhauser. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. I'm Diane Rehn.